This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and the show originates from the Investar Bank Tower. Signature support is derived from East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor's Office, Sharon Weston Broom. And this is Wellness Wednesday, as we are in the middle of a pledge drive, and we ask for your support. And it is essential that you contribute to WRKF. This has been a shining beacon of light, an oasis of civility amid turbulent times occasionally in the last 44 years, and it is your support that makes everything possible. So please give us a call if you can in this hour. It would be nice to hear from you to show your support for Talk Louisiana, and the number is 893-955-9753. And our show number, the one that you dial to participate in our conversation today, is 877-217-5757. And our producers tell me you can go to WRKF.org anytime if you prefer to make your contribution in that realm. And we begin with Nancy Roberts and Christy Sheremy. They are with the Parole Project. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to parole, probation, and sentencing reform in the United States and in Louisiana. The one in Louisiana was founded in 2016 by Andrew Huntley, Robert Lancaster, and Keith Nordyke. Huntley was incarcerated at the state penitentiary at Angola after being sentenced to life in prison for murder, and he has been with us, and this is Second Chance Week, and Nancy Roberts has been involved in many endeavors involving making our world a better place. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you were with the Parole Project on the ground floor, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, I was, and I was, I'm very pleased to be the chairman of their board now, so what an honor that is, and I got involved. I spent my career in education helping teachers, and then I retired, and I've found that this is my third act, maybe. And what I'm really pleased to tell you is that it's been a very healing experience for me. And my sister in 1993, my sister was murdered. So I saw what my family went through, and it was a extremely traumatic experience, and there were many, many wounds to heal. So I'm glad to be involved with the Parole Project.
And before we get to Christy Sheremy, who is also intricately involved here, we have an educated audience, and they told me I need to get the number right, and I do. 855-893-9753. That's your number for WRKF. So please dial that number, 855-893-9753. So there we go. But Christy Sheremy, you speak from experience. You came in the studio today and said you were thankful for your second chance. Can you tell us about your odyssey?
Yes, sir, and good morning. So at the early age of 16, I went to prison for a crime that I didn't commit. But it was a very horrible incident. And I live with those mistakes of my past. I live with those regrets, and I live with that, and I will live with that for the rest of my life. In 2019, because of the 2017 task force, when they changed the law to give juveniles an opportunity at parole eligibility after serving 25 years, when I was in a hopeless situation, during my course of my sentence, I educated myself to give myself opportunities even without an exit.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the law changed, I was resentenced in 2018, became parole eligible after serving 25 years. And the day that I served, that I made my 25th year, I was released.
You said you did not commit the crime. What crime was it?
It was a second degree murder charge.
And how did you get convicted?
I was convicted because I was present at the time that the crime was committed, and I didn't speak. I didn't call anyone. I was scared. I was a 16-year-old kid, and at that particular moment in my life, I was afraid for my own life. So I didn't speak out until later. And
but
I
was you were present.
I was found just as guilty and as the perpetrator.
I can tell you, in 1987, I witnessed an execution of Jimmy Wingo at Angola, June 16, 1987. And he was like you. He was with somebody who killed two people, and he got the death penalty.
Yes, sir.
He was put to death. And we have an uneven, I don't think there's any question, an uneven system of punishment. Some people do terrible things and don't get punished very much, or if at all, and then others do things that are maybe worthy of punishment but get the death penalty in the case I'm talking about. But Nancy Roberts, you speak as a victim.
I do. And, you know, I've been through so many phases since the murder in 1993. And I, the man who, there were two people who murdered Marilyn. One man was, he died of AIDS in a hospital in Galveston, Texas. And then Erica Shepherd is still sitting on death row 31 years later in Texas, and that was the woman who stabbed Marilyn to death.
And when you mentioned Marilyn,
my sister, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of people wouldn't have much compassion. The other day when O.J. Simpson died, Fred Goldman, the father of Ron Goldman, said, "No great loss." I think he would have loved to have seen O.J. Simpson executed. Why are you, and sometimes others, there are many others who are victims of crime, who have a different approach rather than eye for an eye. They believe that there is redemption in this world. Sometimes it's very hard to forgive somebody who's killed a loved one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And but what I want to say here today is how much I believe in the mission of Parole Project, because if I look at my own life, I have had many second chances. And the murder just taught me a lot about forgiveness and do I really practice my faith? And I'm a Catholic, and I believe in forgiveness, and I certainly believe in second chances.
What do they say, or what do you say, about those who contend that if we had a stern system of punishment, that it would be a deterrent to crime?
Well, I believe that where we are now in Louisiana, that we need to do more research on what really does deter crime. And one of the things I've always believed is that if you put more cops on the street, there will be less crime. And I really believe in supporting law enforcement. And because at the moment that person commits the crime, they're not thinking of, I might be, you know, locked up, or I might be put to death. They're not thinking that. They're worried about being apprehended. And that's why I believe so much that we ought to support our law enforcement people.
But some of these people commit crimes and they're back on the streets. They may be also thinking, look, the worst they're going to have, I'll go to jail for a few days, few months, maybe a few years, and I'm out. That's much different than having to think about, if I do this, I might get my life, might lose it.
You know, I am not a sociologist or an expert on that, but I do know that many of the people, our clients at Parole Project, I mean, they've done some horrible things, and they've served like 25, 30 years in prison, and they're old, and they have displayed, during the time they're in prison, they must display an effort to get educated, to learn a skill, to be a good, and they display signs or indications that they will be a good citizen. Now, there's some people who go to prison and don't do a thing, you know, and they are bad people and they need to stay in prison. But there are plenty of people like Christy, and most people, there are 27,000 people in prison now, and they're going to get out. Most of them are going to get out. And are we going to let them out and just not let them say, here's your $25, here's a bus ticket, and you figure it out?
Well, what would you say to people who want to know more about the Parole Project? I know many people may either be victims, or they may have relatives who are in jail right now, and they're looking for answers.
So what I would say, sir, is that Louisiana Parole Project, we focused first. Our mission is to enhance public safety through advocacy programming mm-hmm. so that our returning citizens can be reach their full potential. And we focus, our program focuses not only on the housing, we house our clients, but we help them through weeks of programming that addressed financial management, social norms. Right.
What's the best way to contact
the best way project? To contact the Louisiana Parole Project is through our website, paroleproject.org. And anyone who is interested in knowing anything about the Louisiana Parole Project can definitely reach us through our website.
Well, thank you, Christy. Thank you, Nancy.
And I'd like to invite the governor to my house.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And a reminder that this is now the home stretch of the spring membership drive. And we would like for you to be either a renewed member, a continuing member, or a new member. So if you'd like to participate, the number is 855-893-9753. That's 855-893-9753. And if you make your contribution this hour, you'll get in and out in fewer than 89.3 seconds, and you will have done your good deed, and you will have shown your support for this program, Talk Louisiana. Bob Mann is on deck. Big day for him. He's calling it a career at LSU's Manship School, and he has a major address this afternoon, and he is spending some quality time with us, I guess, in preparation for what is to come this afternoon. But we are wrapping it up with Nancy Roberts and Christy Sheremy of the Parole Project, and this is Second Chance Week, so I know there are some events accompanying the week, and before you leave, I wanted you to at least let our listeners know who might have an interest in what is happening related to this.
Yes, so this week, Louisiana Parole Project is celebrating Second Chance Week. So we have had several events held at our office showing appreciation through to our professionals in corrections as of yesterday. Today, we're going to invite our employers who have partnered off with us at the Louisiana Parole Project. And our volunteers tomorrow will have their appreciation event as well. And so what I would just like the listeners to know that if anyone is in support of Louisiana Parole Project and wants to support, we are focusing on the 27,000 people who will eventually come home. And we want to be able to provide those same services to give them opportunities. It is known that when you invest in someone, they give them, they're able to have a better opportunity at being successful. And we just want our listeners to know that if you believe in the power of second chances and the power of redemption, please support the Louisiana Parole Project.
Nancy, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Sure. I want to say that we want to continue to dialogue with the governor and his people. I want to very much emphasize the effectiveness of this program. And also, I just want to say this is so successful because I've seen this organization grow from a tiny organization in a little tiny office to a staff of 22 where we have social workers. You know, people who get out, I mean, they've never had a cell phone. They've never had a credit card. They don't know how to get a driver's license. Mm-hmm. And then Medicare or they don't know any of that. So you can understand why a person getting out after 30 years in prison, it's like a Rip Van Winkle deal, you know?
All right. Well, thank you very much. And we segue to Bob Mann, standing tall and proud at the Manship School. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Robert Townley Mann, who is a professor of note and author of Consequence and worked for some of the biggest political luminaries in the history of our state, from John Brough to Russell Long to Kathleen Blanco, Bennett Johnston. I'm probably missing a few along the way. He's had quite a life in journalism as he approaches his 66th birthday on September 2nd, but he has logged the last 18 years in the classroom at the Manship School, teaching students about campaigns and political activism. His last lecture Uncivilized behavior, what my students and I learned about political activism and saving our democracy, is open to the public this afternoon, 4:30, in the Holiday Forum at the LSU Journalism Building. Good morning to you, Bob Mann.
Good morning, Jim. Can I just add really quickly that my wife, Cindy, and I are big supporters of the Parole Project. In fact, we made a contribution yesterday, and I hope that all your listeners will support it like we have, because it is truly one of the best organizations in this state, and it deserves your support.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, today you will have, I'm sure, an emotional day. 18 years is a long time. If you were in the U.S. Senate, that'd be three terms. That'd be the same number of terms your old boss, John Breaux, served. And I'm sure when he left the Senate, it was emotional. And I'm sure this will be somewhat of a bittersweet time for you.
It will be. It will be. Bittersweet is the right word. But I want today to be about my students and not about myself. I want to celebrate my students, because that's been the best part of this job, is being around these young people, helping them find their way and supporting their activism and then celebrating them as they go out in the world and change the world. And as I, you know, it's kind of tongue in cheek, but as they try to save our democracy by strengthening that democracy with their activism. So it's going to be a celebration of their work, not mine.
You have been outside of Louisiana to many places. I think, if I remember right, you and Wayne Parent back in 2008, you were in Iowa when Barack Obama had his, I think, the biggest moment as far as his quest for the presidency, when he won the caucuses in Iowa and gave that stirring speech. You were right there, weren't you?
Yeah, we took students to every Iowa caucus from 2008 through 2020, and Wayne and I did it a couple of times, and I and some other colleagues did it, and that truly was one of the most exciting and fun experiences of my time at the Manship School, was taking students to Europe for a study abroad, but taking them to Iowa in January and following these presidential candidates around, and, you know, seeing the birth of Barack Obama's presidency right there in Des Moines that night.
What's been the biggest change in academia in the almost two decades you've been involved at high levels?
Well, I think that it's been, you know, fear and loathing of state government and of politicians coming in and trying to run things in an unhealthy way. As bad as Bobby Jindal was, his main contribution, or the major damage that he did to LSU was budgetary. And I worry now that we're seeing censorship and self-censorship because of fear of what's coming from the governor's office and from the legislature, that's going to really diminish this institution of LSU, but higher education across the state, because state government is getting involved in ways that I think are really unhealthy, and not letting faculty do their jobs in ways that I think if we're allowed to do our work unimpeded by the politicians, we can do good work for this state and for these students, but they're making it harder for us.
877-217-5757 is your number. And last week we had your former colleague at the Manship School, James Carville, with us, and our friend teed off on what he views as faculty lounge politics, political correctness at universities, including LSU. And here's what James Carville had to say last Friday.
Well, you were being interviewed by Maureen Dowd, who of course is brilliant, but You did say, and I know nobody who loves LSU more than James Carville, but you gave up your gig there because you got offended by the way they treated you. What happened?
Well, you know, the time was up. I told the kids showed them how to open a bottle of champagne properly, and I said, as you extract the cork, the sound you're looking for is, quote, the sigh of a satisfied woman, unquote. Now, that's been part of champagne culture for, I don't know, the last 150 years. And one of the co-eds filed a complaint that made her uncomfortable. In LSU's defense, I think the dean had to close out the file or whatever. But I was like, if I, as a teacher, and I found myself, I was scared to have co-eds in my office. You know, a lot of times after class, I always took students out there and go, we'd go to Geno's or the Julio's or, you know. And I was scared to even take females because I think the culture everywhere in the country was such that one person says you did something wrong and your whole life is gone. And I just concluded that if I couldn't talk freely with my students, why be a teacher?
We'll get Bob Mann's take. We are headed for a short pause, and we'll return in short order. And reminder, tonight, 4:30 at the Manship School in the Holiday Forum. That's right in the heart of the building. You'll hear Bob give his farewell address as a 18-year veteran of the Manship School. The number to participate in our drive is 855-893-9753. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. And thanks for your support for WRKF. That number again is 855-893-9753. And thanks to Becky, William, Rebecca, Mark. They all have given within the last 24 hours during this time period. And today is Wellness Wednesday. We're offering a wellness pack to include a WRKF sleek aluminum water bottle, a stylish WRKF bandana in it for $15 a month. So you can do something good for your health and support public radio. And thanks to Stephen, who's also contributed in the last few minutes. And again, the number for the drive is 855-893-9753. We just have a few days left, so time is of the essence, as they say. And you're in and out in 89.3 seconds or fewer seconds, and you'll have done your good deed. Bob Mann is with us, and I'm sure he was absorbing the comments from one Chester James Carville, who never holds back. And if he were not 79 years old, some of the things he said on the show last week would probably get him in a lot of trouble. But he is James Carville, and I think some of the things he's saying are worth listening to. Does he make some good points, Bob Mann?
Well, first of all, James is my good friend, and I was proud to have him as a colleague. and you're right, he doesn't hold back. But, you know, I don't think that it's, you know, I wouldn't, my experience is that, that has not been my experience, that I'm afraid to be around women in and out of the classroom. You know, I don't call them co-eds, so that's not really a term that's that we use anymore. But that's been not my experience. And I, you know, I'm not really sure that I would think that opening a bottle of champagne in the office, I mean, in the office or the classroom would be well received by my students or by the administration. And I just don't think that's not what I taught my students, but, you know, James was free to do what he wanted to do within certain limits, and students were free to complain about it. And I've always encouraged my students to come to me if they have a problem with what I'm teaching or how I'm teaching, or if they don't think they're getting their money's worth, they ought to complain about it. So, and I think we ought to have more students complain than fewer students. So that's one of the themes of my talk today, is that we need to empower our students to speak out.
Well, it is interesting. You have a different point of view than James Carville, but there is this discussion about political correctness on campuses all over the country, and it's viewed by many, and I suspect you would disagree, and I disagree up to a point, but I would say that many campuses now are different than they were when I was in school in the early 1980s. Things that were said then would get professors fired, and we do want an open discussion on campus from all points of view, and we want liberals, conservatives, and everybody in between to have a place at the table. But yet, in many cases, we want a monolithic point of view. We just want a reinforcement of what we believe. And is that really part of the complete learning process, Bob?
Well, I think that's a caricature that's been painted by people who want you to think that higher education, including what happens in my classroom, is brainwashing. And that has not been my experience. That is not what I have ever seen at LSU. And I don't think that's what happens in most universities. That's the caricature that, and I'm not saying this is what James is doing, But I'm saying that that is the caricature that some of the enemies of higher education want to perpetuate, because they don't want more public support for higher education. And one way to undermine that is by portraying this I think very distorted image of it as we're all a bunch of liberals who are trying to brainwash our students. A lot of the students will be coming in from out of town today to listen to my last lecture, and who'll be listening online and who've remained my good friends all these years are Republicans who have appreciated the fact that I've never tried to indoctrinate them, that I tried to support them, encourage them, and help them to be their best version of themselves.
You've had Republicans, I know, speak to your class. And of course, Bob, in his book, Backrooms and Bayous, did I get it right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
You acknowledge that you've made mistakes. And one of those that you acknowledged, and I think maybe you were too hard on yourself. You savagely attacked Buddy Romer when he ran for governor in 1995. And then you met the guy and you realized he's actually not a bad guy, or he wasn't a bad guy, and he was a brilliant man. But you know what? He came to your class and he accepted your apology, didn't he?
He did. I invited him to come to my class, and before I introduced him, I made a public apology for how I had unfairly attacked him. I thought I needed to not just apologize to him personally, but I needed to apologize to him in a similar forum that I'd attacked him. And he was gracious, and Buddy and I became very good friends. I miss him a lot, as I know you do.
Yeah, and I think you liked him at the end a lot more than you liked Edwin Washington Edwards.
I think that's right.
But I'll say this, in most cases, and they both had their weaknesses, and politicians, of course, over time make lots of enemies. But they generally, both of those guys did not hold grudges. And I think the biggest grudge Romer had was against Edwards.
That's right. And I will say Buddy was so gracious to me. I mean, he did not hold a grudge. He forgave me and never mentioned it to begin with, but I never had the feeling that he held any grudge for some of the really nasty stuff that I said about him.
Well, I remember when Clyde Vidreen died, shot outside a courthouse in 1986 by a jealous husband, and he'd written that tell-all book about Edwin Edwards. And Edwards didn't like it a lot, never spoke to Vidreen again. And Edwards is one of those people who generally didn't speak ill of people. But when he died, I called his office for a comment, and a gentleman called back a few minutes later and said, "Roll your tape. I've got the comment from the governor." And the comment was, "Merry effing Christmas."
you got 30 seconds for a related story about that book?
I love that book, by the way. I think it should be used in Louisiana classrooms.
Oh, it's an interesting book. When I covered Edwin Edwards, traveled around the state with him in 1983, people would bring that book to him at rallies.
To sign.
Ask him to sign it. And he would. He'd sign it. Yeah, give me that. Give it to me. And he'd scribble it. And I never thought, I was a dumb young journalist who'd never thought to ask for anybody to show me, what did he sign? I'd love to know what the inscription was.
Well, and one of my professors at LSU was the late, great Brooks Reed, and he said he wrote the book.
And, oh, did he?
Yeah, he didn't get any money for it, but it is a classic. If you can find Just Taking Orders, it is a wild ride about Edwin Edwards.
Eye-opening book. It's if half of it's true, my God.
And it's got stuff in there about friends of ours who probably wish we weren't talking about the book, because I'm sure some people will be curious about it. But that fractured once close relationship between Edwin Edwards and Clyde Vidreen. 877-217-5757. Craig in Natchitoches. Craig, you're on with Bob. Good morning.
Yes, Bob, you just mentioned earlier about your last lecture and being online. Is it by chance online where a non-student can listen in?
Yep.
And if so, what is the link?
Absolutely. The link, if you just go to the Manship School YouTube page, if you just type in YouTube Manship School LSU, it'll take you right to the Manship School YouTube page, and you can watch it live, or if you're busy at 4:30 and want to watch it later, you can see the recording of it later. Thank you for asking that.
Well, it is a big moment for you. And when you started out as a young journalist, I'm sure you had no idea that you were going to be rubbing shoulders with really the giants of Louisiana politics. Talking about Russell Long and John Breaux and Kathleen Blanco, did any of the three ever lose a race?
Well, I guess you could say Kathleen did. You know, she ran for briefly for governor.
But she pulled out, didn't she?
But she wasn't on the ballot, so she didn't technically lose that race because she didn't really officially enter the race. No, I don't believe that any of them ever lost a race. I mean, you know, there was, Russell Long retired before his last campaign, and I don't think John Breaux would have ever lost a race if he'd stayed in politics.
Well, a listener notes that you handled J. Bennett Johnston's campaign when he ran against David Duke, or when Duke ran against him in 1990. And I just remember Johnston at the end of that tortured affair with that forlorn look after Duke got almost 45% of the vote saying, "I got the message." And his message was, "I'm never running again." That was it.
Well, yeah. And it was a surprise because we all thought that we would, you know, Duke would get a lot less than that, and that Senator Johnston would do better than that. The polls suggested that, but we learned a valuable lesson. Not that we took him for granted, or not that we took anything for granted. It was just I don't think we correctly read the amount of anger and racism in this state.
Well, for those who believe that Louisiana's days as a major political force are over, think about it. Joe Biden's budget director is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The ambassador to the UN, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The star witness in the Donald Trump trial, which began yesterday, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mike Johnson, Steve Scalise, go down the list. Mitch Landrieu, Cedric Richmond, all of whom are major players on Capitol Hill and in this campaign. They all cut their teeth in Louisiana. And I would imagine some people will be calling you, Bob, saying, I need you. Will you answer?
Well, no, but, you know, I'll answer, but I'm not looking for another job. I've got another book I'm working on and looking forward to spending more time writing books and spending time traveling with my wife. But you know, about Louisiana, you're right. This state is, it's amazing how much this state has punched above its weight for a long, long, long time. Not just recently, but it's always been that way.
Yeah, when I first started covering politics here, and we had 8 U.S. House members in, and there were Buddy Romer and Lindy Boggs and John Breaux and Henson Moore and Gillis Long. It was quite a crew. Jerry Huckabee, Billy Tozan. It was quite a delegation. We'll talk more with Bob Mann after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. We're in the home stretch, final quarter hour with Bob Mann, who gives his farewell address at the Holiday Forum. That's, you open up the doors of the Journalism School right next to Tiger Stadium, and you'll see the Holiday Forum. And at 4:30, Bob will be giving his final address to students, well-wishers, and maybe even a few frenemies today at LSU. And today is celebrating Wellness Wednesday for WRKF. A wellness pack is yours at $15 a month. The bundle includes a sleek aluminum water bottle, a stylish bandana, and you'll have done your good deed for public radio. 44 years, and 90% of the contributions come either from underwriting or from membership. And the membership list, since I was station manager 20 years ago, has stayed steady at about 4,000. We'd like to increase that number. And we know that many more than 4,000 people listen to the station every week, every day for that matter, every hour. And this particular hour, we know we have more than 4,000 listeners. So if you're on the sidelines, we'd like for you to become a member of the family. Please give us a call, 855-893-9753. That's 855-893-9753. Or go online at WRKF.org. Bob, a listener said you're working on your next book, and Bob has had a varied career, and he's a great biographer. He wrote one of the best biographies of none other than Ronald Reagan, and we knew that the Pulitzer Prize winner, Edmund Morris, he got writer's block when it came to Reagan, but Bob didn't. But what's the next project?
Well, I'll have a book out in the spring of next year. The title is You Are My Sunshine, Jimmy Davis and the Biography of a Song. It's the story of the famous song through the lens of Jimmy Davis's political career.
The second most heard song of all time, I hear, behind Happy Birthday, is You Are My Sunshine.
I think that's right.
James Houston Jimmy Davis, who lived from 1899 to 2000, and he lasted three centuries, so God bless him. And he was governor, you know, in the old days when anybody who was governor could only serve one term and then had to sit out. We had this weird thing in Davis. He was governor both in the 40s and the 60s.
Yeah, he was, and before he was a well-known country music singer, and then after he became a well-known country singer and gospel singer, and then set that aside and came back to be governor, and then went back to his gospel career. I think it's probably the most interesting combination of, even more so than Ronald Reagan in a sense, because Davis was much more successful in the entertainment field than Reagan was, but I think it's one of the most interesting combinations of politics and entertainment in American political history.
Karen Merrifield, who listened to the show last year, she sent me a great photo her father took of Jimmy Davis and John Kennedy, as in President Kennedy, in the back of an open car riding through New Orleans on October 19th, 1962. And Jimmy Davis, in his younger years, he was almost as handsome as President Kennedy, and there they were in the back of a car. And unfortunately, what happened to Kennedy in Dallas could have happened in New Orleans or other places. He took a lot of risks that would not be taken today. Before we go back to the phone lines, I'd promoted it, and a listener wants your take on what's happening in New York City. Yesterday, jury selection began in the hush money trial involving Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen, and Trump was sleeping at the witness table. He is a 70, almost 78-year-old man. Should we give him a break, Bob Mann?
Well, I think, as somebody said on MSNBC the other day, if you're going to call your opponent Sleepy Joe, you have one job,
and to stay awake.
So, I think it's a remarkable thing. Obviously, it's historic, but it's finally Trump is potentially going to have to answer for his conduct in ways that he's never had to do before. And I think it's probably the most distasteful part of it all is not that he might go to prison, which I don't think he will, but that he's got to sit in a courtroom for 8 hours a day for the next 3 or 4 months while he wants to be out playing golf. It's not keeping him from campaigning. It's keeping him from playing golf.
And hearing all kinds of things about his personal life, items he's denied. In fact, at one point, Stormy Daniels denied it too, but she got $130,000 to deny it. Why would you pay somebody $130,000 to keep quiet about something if it didn't happen? This is the man who wrote Art of the Deal. That sounds like Art of the Steal, Bob.
It's a pretty bad deal, right? And that's the whole thing. This is not a hush money trial. This is an election interference trial. I mean, this is a trial that is, this whole hush money was in the context of the Access Hollywood tape coming out. And Trump did not need more bad news about his sexual escapades, his complicated, distasteful sexual life coming out in the days before the election. And so this was hush money to help him win the race. This was, he talks about election rigging. This was election rigging in a way. And that, I think, is the correct framing, the correct legal and otherwise framing of this trial.
A listener says that Dennis Yost and the Classic Four's song Stormy should be Trump's new theme song. Trump, in the last campaign, and I kid you not, at many of his rallies, the opening song was Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones.
There's been some other songs that he's played that have been kind of questionable, right? I mean, I don't think they actually listen to the lyrics of these songs they play at these rallies.
Stuart Downtown. Hello, Stuart. You're on with Bob.
Why, thanks, Jim. Bob, the audience, good morning. Mr. Mann, is it factual that our current Cajun Caesar is one of the reasons why you're leaving LSU early? And what do you think of him wanting to strip students scholarships for not wanting to be present for the anthem? And will you remain in political consulting?
All right. What about?
Well, thanks for the question, Stuart. I'm not going to remain. I'm not a political consultant. I haven't been for a long time, so I'm not going back into that field. But I'm leaving partly. You know, I was always going to retire in the next few years. But when Landry tried to fire me or get LSU to fire me for attacking his lies about COVID vaccines a couple of years ago, I realized that if he became governor, that I would be a very inconvenient a sore thumb for my school, and I'm leaving because I don't want my school, the Manship School, or LSU in general, to be hurt because of my presence there. So I'm leaving a few years earlier than I originally intended, and it's mainly because of Jeff Landry.
Louisiana Public Schools, and a listener asked me to note this story. It's on 10A in the Advocate today. Patrick Wall wrote it. Public schools in our state would be barred from teaching about systemic racism under a bill the state Senate passed 28-11. Senate measure 262 forbids public schools from teaching that students endure or cause oppression due to their race or national origin, language that could be interpreted as restricting lessons on systemic or institutional racism. And the 28-11 vote had all 11 Democrats in the Louisiana Senate voting against it. It heads to the House. It's sponsored by Valerie Hodges of Denham Springs and is expected to be passed by the House and signed by the governor. Is this a big deal, or is this basically just another blip on the oscilloscope of history?
No, I think it's a big deal because they'll say that they're not prohibiting teaching of the history of slavery or the civil rights movement. But if you're a teacher, you're going to self-censor. You're going to wonder if you can get away. You're going to worry about that parent who's offended that little Johnny is learning about the civil rights movement, about Martin Luther King or John Lewis or Malcolm X, and you're not going to teach it. And so our education system is going to be dumbed down in ways that it's going to hurt us and put us behind. We're already pulling up the rear in education in this country. Why would we want to make our students less informed about our nation's history? It's just tragic.
I was reading the Atlanta Constitution's Sunday edition, by the way, a very good newspaper. They still do a nice job. And they had the 10 fastest growing metro areas in the country. And number one is Dallas. Number two is Houston. Number three is Atlanta. And here we are in Louisiana. I saw New Orleans is down to 1 million metro, down from 1.3 at its height. And so while Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Miami, they're growing, all these cities were about the same size as New Orleans in 1960. They're in the top 10. In fact, Atlanta, Dallas, and Houston are three of the top six now metro areas in the country. What happened, Bob?
Well, I mean, and New Orleans used to be the magnet. New Orleans used to be one of the wealthiest cities, the wealthiest and most populous city in the South. And we lost our advantage. Well, we still have all those advantages, but we kicked them away. And a lot of it, I think, is because of our politics. We don't value people from the outside like other states do. The reason things have changed in places like North Carolina and Texas and, you know, Houston, Dallas, and Atlanta is because they've welcomed people from other states. They've welcomed the best and brightest from other places to come in there and transform and renew those places. And we have just not found a way to do that. We're way too insular. And what's going on in the legislature today and next week and next month and next year will only make this place even more insular and put up a large sign saying outsiders are really not that welcome here.
Mm-hmm. 202 days from the presidential election, and Helen Monroe asks you to look into your crystal ball. Who do you think will win?
I think it's Biden's to lose at this point. I really do. I think that, especially with abortion being the major issue in this campaign, I think we're going to see the kind of results that we've seen in every election since Trump's been on the ballot. But especially every election we've seen since the Supreme Court overruled Roe versus Wade. And I think that women are going to once again save this country from disaster and ruin.
Well, thank you, Bob. 4:30 today, you can see and hear Bob at the Manship School for his final address. Always a pleasure, and we'll keep in touch and appreciate what you've done for our school and our state. Appreciate it, Bob. Take care.
Thank you, Jim.
Stay safe and stay tuned.